Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast. This is Matt Sainsbury. I'm the Editor-in-Chief of digitallydownloaded.net, and with me this week we have Ginny. Hello, Ginny.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
All good. And we also have Harvard. Hello, Harvard.
Hello.
So this podcast is a little bit unusual. We are recording it well in advance. By the time you're listening to this, I'm actually going to be in Japan, and we weren't able to record at the normal time because I was in transit and stuff. So yeah, we're actually recording this a couple of weeks in advance. Apologies if we say something that no longer is relevant, but we'll do our best to be on track anyway. Okay, so we'll listen to a bit of music and then we'll get going. And welcome back, everybody. So, given that I am in Japan by the time you listen to this podcast, I figured that for the first section of the podcast this week, we'd actually do something a little bit different and not talk so much about games, although that's certainly relevant when you're talking about Japan. But we talk about Japan itself and some of the great stuff that you can get up to while you're over there. And believe it or not, it's not all about Akihabara and Hatsune Miku. There is other stuff you can do when you're in Japan. And it's great. I go over every year for a month or so. My in-laws are over there. So you know, we've got a place to stay, which helps because hotels are quite expensive in Japan. But yeah, well, I spend a solid month over there going around and doing a whole bunch of different things. This year, while I'm there, I'm going to go to Tokyo Game Show, as I always do, and also the Hatsune Miku concert at the start of the month, which by the time you're listening to this podcast, I would have already been to. It was great, I can tell you that right now. And then, yeah, other than that, I do a lot of other things that don't necessarily have much to do with games. I generally go and explore some of the countryside because Japan has some very lovely countryside. And we go to various events that happen. There's always some kind of festival or other. This time of year over in Japan, it is humid as hell and very unpleasant. But yeah, there's always stuff you can do to get out of the heat and the humidity. But yeah, I guess have either of you two been to Japan at any point?
Yes, I
You have?
have. Yep, multiple times with my family. My brother likes going for Akihabara and Miku. So we've been dragged around multiple times. I had a couple of trips when I was sort of too young to really appreciate it. But as I got older, I guess when I first started university, my parents and my family took a whole trip to Japan together to celebrate. That was really nice. So the first couple of times were very sort of like, I would say, very Tokyo centric. Because, like normally when you first go to a new place for a holiday, you don't really know what to do apart from the touristy things. So the first couple of times it was very much very Tokyo, Shinjuku, Akihabara sort of type stuff. And then later on we went to Osaka and Kobe and Nara and other places like that. So I think I've had a good breadth of experience when it comes to stuff that I've done in Japan. But definitely, I would say if you are going to Japan or you haven't been before, you do want to go. I think if you really want to get like a feel for Japan, I would say if you really want to, go to Tokyo and stuff like that. But I think the real history is in places like Osaka and Kobe and obviously cool things like Nara. So I would recommend, I think, to someone, absolutely Nara. For people that might not know what I'm talking about from the name, it is that place on Twitter that everyone posts about. It's got a ton of deer. So you should 100% go there and visit. The deer are really enthusiastic about your belongings and your backpacks and getting to know you in the hopes that you feed them food. It's a very family-friendly place. I think it's a great for like a family holiday. And also, I mean, anyone of any age can enjoy cuddling up to some deer. So 100% Nara. I thought Kobe was really cool. I really liked Chinatown in Kobe. When I went there with my parents are like obsessed with seeking out the Chinatown of a particular country.
Literally.
So like I think for them, because being Chinese is like, this thing that they're familiar with. And so they love the Chinatown in Kobe. It was really great. It was awesome. So recommend if your family members are like that and they're, I would say like traditional Chinese grandparents slash parents always want to do stuff like that and you won't regret it. So there's a whole ton of history surrounding Kobe. So as Matt famously said, it's where the Yakuza go to party.
Yeah,
So
it
it's
is the
definitely,
it's the headquarters of the Yakuza are over that way, so it's quite famous for that. It's also really famous for its beef.
Yes, that's right.
Kobe Wagyu beef is world renowned for being the highest quality Wagyu beef there is. You pay a fortune for it, but it is worth every yen. It's really good. In terms of Chinatowns, the other Chinatown that's everybody recommends and I've been to and it's really amazing is the Yokohama Chinatown. Yokohama's Chinatown is the largest Chinatown outside of China. So yeah, it's and that's Yokohama was following World War II, that was the place where the Japanese government tried to keep all the gaijin as much as possible. So it's a really cosmopolitan kind of city. In terms of history, the other places that are really worth recommending, Kyoto's an obvious one. Matt C, who's not on the podcast this week, but he would recommend Kyoto the moment you mentioned that you're going to Japan. And it's certainly an amazing city with a lot of history and heritage for obvious reasons. Personally, I'd also recommend you go to Kamakura, which is a little bit south of Yokohama. It's about an hour train ride out of Tokyo. Kamakura was actually the capital city of Japan before even Kyoto was, and it is a very old city now. These days, it's mostly kind of a leisure city for fairly wealthy individuals or artists to live within, a rough commuting distance of Tokyo if they need to go into the city. So it's got that kind of laid-back vibe. It's got the beach culture. Is in Kamakura, and it's got that really old history. So, Yeah, those are kind of my recommendations outside of Tokyo. I do agree that while you could spend a month in Tokyo by itself and still not see anywhere near everything that it has to offer, the real fun in Japan is getting out of the major city and seeing what else the country offers. So Harvard, I mean, have you been to Japan?
Yeah, but I only went on a short 7-day trip, so I did stay mostly in Tokyo. Funny thing is that I went with my friends, but we synced it badly, so that when I was in Tokyo, they were in Hokkaido, and I just had the whole Airbnb to myself. I was traveling around the whole city, didn't know a bit of Japanese, and it was just a very confusing experience. But I did really enjoy it. What I love about that city, and what I love about a lot about Japan and all, is that the food is really good, but there's this delicacy culture. Or if you go to a certain place, you should try this food. And growing up in Australia, we don't have that. We just there's nothing like that here. So that was really interesting, being able to experience the different cultures through the different foods that were available. It was really amazing. I spent, I think, one day in Osaka, and I ate like 7 meals. Everything was so good.
The food in Japan is just amazing, I agree. If you are going to do a food tour, the other place that you should definitely go is Hiroshima. Hiroshima is obviously the site of the nuclear bomb, and there's an awful lot of memorials and history there about that, and it's worth going to for that reason as well. But Hiroshima is best known for its okonomiyaki, which is a Japanese pancake, I guess you could call it. But yeah, it uses cabbage, and it's a savory rather than a kind of dessert thing like pancakes are here, and meat, and it's really good, really, really good. And yeah, Hiroshima is definitely best known for that. The other thing I have to recommend is get off the major island if you can. The three other large islands that comprise kind of the mainland of Japan, Hokkaido, Shikoku, and Kyushu, they're also all amazing, and they're a little bit more rural, especially Shikoku, which is probably my favorite island in Japan. The cities there are very small, the mountains are higher for the most part, and it's more rugged. And yeah, you just be kind of on a train, or you'd be walking along, and you come to these layered kind of rice fields, because they're cut into the mountain because they've got so little flatland to work with, and it's the most amazing sight. You could spend a lot of time just kind of walking around that place, and everybody's very country and very friendly. And yeah, it's definitely a visual experience. And yeah, some of the other places that are probably worth visiting if you ever get a chance to go to Japan, there's Tottori is a very interesting place to visit.
Ooh.
A very interesting place to visit. And it's been referenced in a couple of games in recent years because it has that kind of that rural countryside appeal to it. Going up to Hokkaido, there's the city itself in Hokkaido, the major city Sapporo, is a really interesting little city, or quite large city. It is actually the third biggest city in Japan after Tokyo and Osaka. It's also where Hatsune Miku comes from. That's actually a major thing up there. The Sapporo Airport has a Hatsune Miku life-size statue, and has a shopping area that is you can get all these Hatsune Miku goods that are only there. But beyond that, being up there for winter, they have a massive snow festival, and they create the most amazing ice sculptures in the middle of the city, as part of that, because they get a lot of snow. It's very cold up there in winter, but well worth visiting. I guess, yeah, I mean, everywhere you go in Japan, you're going to see something that's interesting. And the good thing about it is it's all very easy to get to. The Shinkansen gets you anywhere very quickly. Domestic airlines are there, I guess, if you don't want to use the train. Although most people would use the train wherever possible. It's a little bit more expensive, I guess, than an airline. I think it's about $100 for a one-way trip between Osaka and Tokyo via Shinkansen, which isn't terrible. The only reason you need to use a domestic airline is for some of the smaller islands, or somewhere like Okinawa, which is their tropical paradise. And yeah, what else can we recommend? I mean, obviously, if you're going there, if you're a listener of the podcast, you're probably interested in at least visiting Akihabara, and fair enough. That's
yes.
That's an amazing little place. It's a very, it's a sensory overload, I think, is the best way to explain it. There's a lot of colour, a lot of noise, a lot of energy, and it's really good. And there's all kinds of cute things that there. Like the local shrine in Akihabara is worth visiting because, yeah, they've got a lot of anime stuff going on there, which is not something you'd expect to see in a shrine, but they fully embrace the culture of the city. There's even the Love Life cafe from the anime. That is actually there and was there before the anime. It's an actual cafe that's become famous since the anime because every fan of it wants to drop in and get, you know, have a coffee and whatever there. And it's really fun. But I'd also recommend, if you are a fan of that stuff, to also head over to Nakano Broadway, which is another suburb, another shopping mall in Tokyo. And it's quirky and different and even weirder in some ways than what the Akihabara shopping malls are, and it's a fascinating place to visit, and I almost prefer going there for my anime goods shopping because you can find more stuff there. Really, it's really good and very odd shopping mall that you wouldn't see anywhere else. So if you get a chance, look up Nakano Broadway and head over there. I think it was actually depicted in one of the Digimon games that was released.
Oh yeah, Digimon Cyber Sleuth. That's, you ever play one. That?
Yeah, that's
the. And you go to Nakano Broadway. It messes with your head because the recreation is so perfect.
Yes,
the individual stores are exactly the same. It just blew my mind.
Damn.
Yeah, it is. It's an amazing. And the funny thing about that game was I actually found myself getting lost trying to find my way around, which is exactly the same as Nakano Broadway, because the hallways are very thin and they kind of wind around and there's very poor signposting. You can get very lost in Nakano Broadway. And every year I go, I'll shop around and look for what I might want to buy. And I'll say, I'll get this figure from here, or I'll get something from this shop. And then I won't be able to find that shop again. So I'll be dragging my wife around trying to find the bloody shop for half an hour after when I finally decide I want to buy the things. So it's a very odd shopping mall and it's really good fun. And you get a lot of stuff there that you can't even get at Akihabara. So go to both if you've got the time .
Yeah, I find that Akihabara has the most current anime merchandise. So the stuff that's popular at the moment, there's going to be stores devoted just to that. Whereas you go to Nakano Broadway, you get the little quirky stuff from maybe 10 or so years ago that you never thought you would have found, but then it's still there. And Ikebukuro is also pretty good if you want that kind of stuff. It's more metropolitan.
Yeah, Ikebukuro is probably more... It's more general electronics as opposed to kind of anime nerd culture, otaku culture. So it's got bigger electronic stores, and it's certainly a very impressive city in its own right. It's slightly different in tone, though. It's not quite as nerdy, as geeky as the others. It's, that being said, that's actually where Compile Heart's offices are. And I got to drop in there when I was doing interviews for my book. I got to go to their offices in Ikebukuro, and it's interesting. They've got a lovely office. It's really good fun. Good people. What else can I suggest? I guess the only other thing is if you are thinking of going to Japan, I would definitely recommend planning it around the Olympics, I think. If you can get over there at all for 2020, I think that will be a really special experience. The good thing, the public transport system will actually work, so the crowds won't be such a problem as they might be in other cities when they have an Olympics. And the atmosphere will be really good, and it'll be a city at play, even more so than normal. And I think you'll have a really good time.
30,000 throngs ever since Donkey Kong. Seething down every pipe, despite his plum-shaped body type. Who's gonna run in fear while screaming, Mamma Mia? Who leaves me gray and grim? Oh, what does Peach see in him? Mario! With great joy in my heart, each time I watch Mario Kart, you're first and doing so well. But here come the spiny shell! And now you and your rabby friends have finally met your end. Just let me catch my breath, then I see you today.
And welcome back, everybody. So, getting back on track with, in terms of talking about games and stuff, the thing we thought we'd talk about first up this week is Danganronpa as a concept, as a genre, as a, well, it's kind of a genre into itself, but as a series. The reason we're talking about it is that Danganronpa 3 is out fairly soon, by the time you're listening to this podcast. And yeah, we're all fans of all the craziness that is Danganronpa. So Ginny, I mean, you've played all of them, haven't you, so far?
Every single one. Most recently, actually, Ultra Despair Girls, which I didn't play at the time that it came out, but more recently, on you and Matt Codd's recommendations. So, where to start? I guess I think people think that Danganronpa is... I think people maybe have some fundamental misconceptions about what Danganronpa is. I mean, I've had friends who have played probably, I don't know, like the first one and then just decided that the rest of it wasn't for them, or like just never finished the game, first of all. Obviously, no hate if you haven't finished the game. Life gets tough, you know, everything gets in the way. Totally understand. Just putting it out there, like, that's fine. But I think people that sort of like pick it up and then don't start again and go, oh, it wasn't really my thing, I didn't really like it, I would recommend giving it another go. I think Danganronpa, what put some people off might be the cheesiness, and also obviously our good friend Monokuma. I had a mate that said that he was just too creepy, so she couldn't keep going. But I think in forming that opinion after only playing maybe half an hour, I think you really should go through and try and finish one of them. I think it's smarter than most people give it credit for. It's kind of like I think it reminds me in terms of how an anime like Dead Man Wonderland was received. Some people thought it was incredibly stupid and it was very gimmicky. But then I think that Monokuma and the use of someone like Monokuma, I think, as sort of like a bridging plot device to be the embodiment of evil, I think it really sort of like turns that whole like Japanese creepy cute concept up to like, you know, the nth degree. I think there's a lot to like about Danganronpa. For me, a lot of it is about the subversion of what you would expect a lot of female characters to react like and to behave like in a situation like that. I think it really has good commentary about humanity's potential for brutality as well, and also like what we think, or I guess what people think vengeance should be executed like, or what vengeance and revenge actually means to different people. I think Danganronpa goes really deep into personal stories, which is what I liked about it. And also what I liked about Ultra Despair Girls was how different it was and how dark and scathing it was as a critique. I think, Matt, as you felt the same way about Ultra Despair Girls. And I think some people are just so put off by the Despair Girls bit that they just see it as like, you know, just an excuse to use young women in a game. And I think that surface level reception is what Danganronpa suffers from in the commercial market. People see, oh, it's got It's got anime girls. It's got a little bit of upskirt. You know, it's got some creepy bear, and it's got all these kids killing each other like a battle royale type mode, and they just completely forget about the other parts of the game that make it a really good vehicle for storytelling, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that, like, the Danganronpa games, the main two, Danganronpa and then the sequel, they're quite deep in the sense that they explore game theory, which is an economic and philosophical theory about how people respond in situations like that, and you know how people actually respond not just in situations like that, but in society in general. Those theories, basically, you can apply them to the business world, and it tells you how to make an awful lot of money and exploit a lot of people and things like that. So, yeah, the Danganronpa games are kind of an exploration of that idea, and they're quite smart in the way that they do that. Ultra Despair Girls doesn't have so much of that theme, but it does have you know, various themes about how you know, the relationship between children and adults, and the way that adult society can exploit can affect children's society, and it gets into some very dark places.
Yeah.
But it needs to again to explore its themes. These games, to me, they're great because they are very thematic and very heavy on the themes, as opposed to just telling a nonsense story about a bear going crazy and killing a lot of people, or bringing about the deaths of a lot of people. And I think a lot of people miss that kind of stuff because, yeah, who wants to think deeply when they're playing a game? But, yeah, I think they're quite smart. I think they're very smart, actually. And that's certainly what I'm looking forward to with the next one. I hope it holds up to that. And I think it will. I hope. There's always a risk that it will go too far. It will start to focus on the stuff that people talk about the most, which is the weirdness and the monokuma and stuff, without giving him the context and the thematic depth that makes him such an interesting character.
Mm.
Because I mean, I've argued that Monokuma isn't so much the bad guy as such, because you know he's kind of more he's a mirror to, you know, people's own behaviors, and he's not really doing anything himself. He's really just facilitating people to, you know, indulge their human nature and stuff. And you know, is that so bad, or is that more just a reflection on, you know, humanity and stuff like that? So there's a lot of conversations you can have about Danganronpa, and that's what I like about it, and I'm hoping that the third one does much the same. I know you've only played the first one, Harvard, but what were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think I reviewed the first one for the site a while back, actually. It's definitely a game that keeps you up at night, because the story is paced so adeptly that you keep wanting to find out what happens next, and there's always some plot thread that you're just wondering about. And I thought that was what made it so exhausting for me, was that you couldn't just stop, you had to keep going and figure out what happened next. And it's so reliant on plot twists as well. Or at least that's what I felt. Like you mentioned before, Ginny, about how no one is exactly as they seem, like the subversion of expectations all the time.
Mm.
It's a very exhausting game, but maybe that's just my preference. And so I haven't gotten around to the second one. I'm sure it's good, just I've never found that space in my life where, like, oh yeah, I definitely want to set aside some time for this, you know?
And it's not a small amount of time either. These things are quite long.
Yeah.
I think the first Danganronpa, realistically, you clock it in 20 hours or so. The second's probably a slight touch longer, I want to say. Ultra Despair Girls is relatively short, but then it's, as an action kind of game, it's relatively long. So, yeah, if you were to play the three of them, you'd be looking at, a solid 50 hours, I'd say, to work through all three of them. It. Yeah. And that's a lot. that's a big time commitment. And I think people go into them expecting them to be relatively short games because they look anime and kind of cheap, in quotation marks. And I don't think people quite expect them to be that kind of deep, long experience that rivals, you know, an RPG in terms of content. But yeah, I think they're worth it. At least the first one. The first one's definitely the stronger of the two main ones. And yeah, if you got along with it, then you'll get along with the second as well. Welcome back. And for the last section of the podcast this week, we thought we'd talk about a genre, different one to in the last couple of weeks. We talked about platformers and JRPGs and all that other stuff. But this week, we thought we'd talk about party games. So one of the reasons that a lot of us got into gaming in the first place was getting friends around and sitting around a console and mashing buttons and having a good laugh, having some pizza, having some beer if we were old enough or if parents weren't around. and yeah, so it's something that I think pretty much everyone who plays games enjoys. And I think we'll start with Harvard. Harvard, in terms of party games, what are the kind of the go-tos for you, and are there any that have come out recently that kind of really hooked you and friends?
I think the house staple for me is probably Jackbox series.
Yes, they're amazing.
It's one where you play on your phone and you get a couple of different prompts. So there's a lot of different games, and it's all about how you respond to certain questions or like how you draw things or whatever. It relies on your friends to be funny, to be enjoyable, but it does it in this great atmosphere that's it's great at any party. And I think recently I reviewed Nidhogg 2, which is also pretty good. it's not what you think a party game would be like. It's more of like a fencing, stabby kind of game, but it's the speed and energy of it makes it a good game for if you got two people and they like to compete, or if you've got like competitive friends. It's easy to pick up, easy to learn, and so that makes it pretty popular.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I haven't played an Nidhogg game, I must admit, but I do like the Jackbox games for party situations for the same reason. They're really good fun. Another one that has been on high rotation since PlayStation VR came around was, I can't remember the name of it now, but it's the one person with the VR goggles on has a view of a bomb.
Oh, it's like keep talking and no one blows up or something like that.
Yeah, that's the one. That's what it's called. Yeah, so this is a really good one. And then everybody else has a different set of information on the screen and they need to communicate with the person with the VR headset on to figure out how to defuse the bomb, because the person with the VR headset can't see the additional information. And it's stuff like, you know, if this light's on, you need to do this with this switch and that kind of stuff. And the people who are looking at the screen have the bomb defusal manual, which is, you know, something like 40 pages of various, you know, bits and pieces that they need to sort through, but they can't see the bomb. So there needs to be that kind of two-way communication, and you've only got a couple of minutes to try and solve the bomb problem. And yeah, it's really good fun. It's quite difficult to communicate well, or maybe I'm just really bad at talking to people, but we have a really good blast with that. And then, of course, there's the classics, and the Nintendo Switch has been really good for that. The Bombermans, the Mario Karts, and Smash Brothers, once it finally comes to Switch, which I'm sure will happen, they will be high rotation as well. Good console for party games already. What do you think, Ginny?
I think the Switch is the bomb. I think Mario Kart, obviously, amazing. Pokken Tournament is also going to be 100% great as a multiplayer game. And I think one that gets overlooked a lot, well, I say a lot, I mean by the quote-unquote mainstream, I think Overcooked on the Switch is great. I honestly think Overcooked is a great game, and I think on the Switch it's just so much easier to play with a whole bunch of people. The mechanics make sense, how everything controls makes sense, and I mean, like, it's just perfect for the Switch, like Mario Kart was, you know?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Overcooked doesn't work as a single player game, I think.
Yeah, 100%.
But yeah, in multiplayer it's just all kinds of fun. So anybody who hasn't seen Overcooked before, basically what it is it's a chef game. You have a couple of little chef dudes in a kitchen, and they've got to fulfill orders by, you know, chopping up lettuce and sizzling meat and, you know, making hamburgers and then delivering them to the customer, washing up the plate afterwards, all that kind of stuff.
It doesn't sound fun if you describe it, but it's a really good experience. Like, sometimes when I'm home, I'll hear from the other room people just yelling, like, give me the tomato, we eat the tomato. Yeah. And then, yelling, it's great.
Yeah, wash the plate. Give me the beef. Where is the beef? I need beef.
Are you sure you're playing a game, or is that just like, you know, normal day-to-day kitchen conversations? Wash the plate. I get that one. But yeah, it is. It's just great fun. And I think a lot of people, unfortunately for party games, a lot of critics when they're reviewing them don't really have the capacity to play them in the kind of the environment that they're designed for. A bunch of people around and beers and chips and stuff, and they review them as single player kind of experiences. And yeah, obviously they're going to lose a lot of the appeal in doing that. I think there's a couple of Mario Party over the years has been similar. I've liked quite a few of those, but they don't work as single player games at all.
I think must have been a year ago, I reviewed Party Golf for PS4. And this is back when I had one controller, because PS4X controller is like $1 billion. And so I didn't feel it, but now that we got a second one and we started playing it multiplayer, it's so much better than I gave it credit for. I feel terrible. Like, I saw the guys who made it at PAX, and I just wanted to go out there and be like, I'm sorry, your game is amazing. It's a golf game in 2D, but it's got a bunch of mods to it. So sometimes, like, meteors will fall from the sky, or, like, you can do boosts in midair and, like, all this crazy stuff. And it's so simple, but adding people just makes it a completely different game. I definitely recommend it.
Yeah, absolutely. Another good one I find for that is Screen Sheet, another Aussie developer, actually. That was a lot of fun, but not so much online multiplayer. It's really a kind of local multiplayer experience. So anybody who hasn't played Screen Sheet, basically it's split screen first person shooter, but it removes the character models from the other person's screen, which sounds weird, I know. What you have to do is you have to look at the other person's quarter of the screen to figure out where they are so you can line up your shot and hit them. So it kind of plays to that. Everybody used to play it back in the day of GoldenEye or whatever, where you'd be yelling at your friends for looking at your corner of the screen in multiplayer. Like, stop looking. And people came up with these really elaborate kind of setups using pizza boxes and stuff. So you wouldn't be able to look at other people's screens, and you'd all be, you'd divide the TV into four little quarters, and everybody was only allowed to look in their quarter. So Screen Sheet kind of plays with all that stuff, and it's really good fun. It's very nostalgic. It's really good. But again, if you play it online, you lose a lot of that because you don't have the person-to-person interaction that you have in the local multiplayer experience. So yeah, there's a few of those games that are like that. And it's tough for, I think, the developers, because it's tough to get people to review them in the context that they kind of design the game in mind of. And then, of course, once the negative reviews or the flat reviews kind of hit, it kind of kills the atmosphere for the game, or the kind of the response to the game. So, yeah, it's not much you can do about it. If you've got to review the game, you've got to review the game. But it's there are some that are definitely designed around a large kind of multiplayer experience.
Mm.
I mean, Jackbox is the same thing. They only work when you've got a lot of people in the room.
Oh yeah, you have to review that by yourself.
Yeah,
you're a nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have to have like four phones and pretend to be funny to yourself. Oh, this is sad.
Oh my god.
Yeah, and I'd even say that two or three people to test Jackbox wouldn't be enough. You really do need to have a large group of people, because the more people...
Yeah, we decided the critical amount is 5, because we have the tiebreaker vote. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
Yeah. Unless you've got that kind of volume of people and that volume of noise as people start yelling back and forth at one another. Those games just kind of don't work, unfortunately. Or fortunately. But then again, I mean... You wouldn't play a board game by yourself either, would you? So,
on that point before, though, it kind of blows my mind that FPS games used to be considered party games. Like, now that I think about it, I was a bit young for GoldenEye, but we spent a lot of time on the first Halo and on Time
Squad. Yeah, I was going to say,
and Halo. I'm just thinking, like, now no one does that. That's just... You would never go to a party and play an FPS game. That would just feel weird.
Yeah, I mean, do they even still do split screen?
I think they... stopped for some games, but I know that Halo still does it.
Yeah.
The fun stuff is gone. Like, I remember used to play Griffball, which is like football but with hammers.
Yeah.
And they don't focus on the arcadey aspect of it anymore. It's all just like online multiplayer ranked, be the best Halo dude.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think Call of Duty, if I went to a party and they were like, what should we play? And I was like, oh, Call of Duty World War II, I'd be kicked out of the party. It's not... I think, like, the arcade mode that people were still, like, grinding in Halo 2 and Halo 3 was probably, I think, the best for multiplayer. Like, I mean, I would play multiplayer Lucio Ball at a party. You know, like, stuff like that. Like, I would play all the arcade game modes of current FPS games at a party, but I wouldn't ever be like, you know what's going to be a really great time, guys? Call of Duty multiplayer. Let's play ranked. Like, it would just be awful. Yeah.
Yeah, the other one that I feel has lost a little bit in terms of its value as a multiplayer kind of party game is sports games, which sounds odd because, you know, you naturally want to play FIFA or whatever when you've got friends around. But the thing is, those games have become quite complex in how they work.
Oh, I can totally watch for that. My housemate has NBA 2K17. It's so hard. It is the hardest game I've ever played. I've played a lot of games. It's so hard. The preciseness that you need to move the sticks to shoot properly and everything, it's just, it blows my mind how people play that game.
Yeah, and I mean, I can understand. I know, because I've done it with some sports games myself, I'm a big fan of PES, so I play those quite a lot when they come out each year. you get good at them and you feel good, and they feel like a really good simulation of the sport. But you have a friend come over and you try and play it, it's just not fun for anybody because, yeah, they take practice. And, yeah, it's just – they used to be – I remember, yeah, you used to have friends come over and you'd pick FIFA out and you'd play it on the N64 or whatever as part of the Mix the Games. And it wouldn't matter any as much if people weren't so good because there was like two buttons, pass and shoot. But, yeah, things have definitely changed and sports games are now much more – hardcore activity, which is a bit disappointing why that recent NBA jam.
Oh, the NBA Playgrounds or whatever.
NBA Playgrounds was so terrible because, yeah, I think there's still demand and interest in having kind of arcade sports games that people can pick up and play, but nobody's really supplying them. And that game could have been a chance to change that, but it was terrible.
Like, yeah, I think now we're seeing more the idea of sports skate party games like Rocket League and
yeah,
all the other ball games like Party Golf. They're not really anything like the sport, but they're funny enough and easy enough that you can just share it in 5 minutes with a friend and you'd enjoy it a lot more.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that's... As games have become more of a sport in themselves, I guess developers have felt unburdened by the need to tie themselves to real-world sports, if that makes sense. Mm. And you've seen stuff like Rocket League come out and look and feel like a sports game, even though that game would be that as a real sport, that would be absolutely impossible. But yeah, I don't know.
Mm. It's not that realism is bad podcast.
I don't know if I'd play Rocket League in a party because I'd suck so badly at that.
I think Rocket League has too much momentum. Like, I think it would kind of be disruptive at a party. Like, Mario Kart, I know, is like, you know, high speed and whatnot, but I still think you can like sort of like lean back on the couch, play Mario Kart, have a beer later and be chill, but Rocket League doesn't have much chill at all.
Yeah, Mario Kart's good. I think, actually, funnily enough, the Mario and Sonic at the Olympic Games and stuff like that work quite well for multiplayer sports games. They're not great games by any means, but if you're going to pull one out for an hour, you can have good fun with friends mashing some buttons and stuff. That kind of stuff.
Did either of you ever play 1-2 Switch?
No.
No.
I did not.
Okay. If it ever goes on sale, just get it to show your friends how weird party games can be.
What is 1-2 Switch?
That's the one where you milk the cow.
It's the one where you milk the cow. It's one of the launch titles for the Switch.
Sorry, what?
It's like Nintendo Land, but like quicker mini games.
It's the one where you what the cat?
Okay, so you know the Switch controller, right? Your house got the ZL and ZR buttons.
Yeah.
So there's a mini game where you press those buttons and pull it down as if you're milking a cow, and the person who milks more is the winner. And there's all these mini games like that are super weird. There's one that like you're using the Joy-Con to spin a plate, and then you're supposed to knock the plate out of the other person's hands.
Oh,
it's all this weird stuff that's ingenious but weird.
Okay.
So, yeah, recommended if you have friends who don't mind looking a bit stupid.
Yeah, I'm definitely gonna get that then because my mates are idiots. Like, I'm just
and you got like $5 because it's probably not worth much more than that.
Yeah, hopefully it's not expensive now.
It's not expensive, is it? Like, I'm just gonna look it up right now because
I wouldn't buy it at the launch price, to be honest. But because it's only like 23 mini games, it's not.
It's like $60.
Oh, yeah.
It's
wait.
$60.
It's not one that much.
Is that? I'm sorry. I mean, I don't know if I would pay $60. If I had to, I would rather give my mate $60 to milk like a real life cow as he was like really, really drunk. That would be $60 worth. I don't know if I would pay. I mean, conceptually, I mean, sure. Jesus.
What are your mates get up to? Here's $60. Go milk this cow.
No, honestly, like I I've got some mates that would do anything for like a McChicken. So it's just like 2 a.m. on a Friday night. Like, honestly, you could buy one of us do something really, really drunk and stupid for a McChicken. So I'm just saying, there's not a lot to do in New Zealand. So, you know, shit. You make your own fun. Yeah, you got to make your own fun. And we have a whole ton of cows and a whole ton of livestock. So all I'm saying, it's a natural fit, you know? So, oh, God, that looks, yeah. Yeah, if it ever goes on sale for $5, you know, 100%, count me in. I would get that. But, oh, it's a lot of money. Oh.